911, what's your emergency?
What are you wearing?
Nothing at all. I think that's good. I think that's fun.
We've officially become a not safe for work podcast.
Officially. I like that in our Buck Abby, I guess, role play or whatever, I'm Abby.
I'm Buck. We always knew this was the case.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like with the amount of like lesbians on Twitter that I've seen that like very much identify with Buck, like that tracks.
This is a very lesbian fandom. I've noticed that.
Oh, Slay. Yeah. It's like, I feel like it's more sapphic than most other, I don't want to say that, like I don't know if it's more sapphic than, like, Supernatural. That felt pretty sapphic, but,
think,
like.
Yeah, there was plenty of that. I also, it's kind of like what I talked about in my Steric video, where, like, I feel like there were a lot of people who, like, joined those fandoms as people who thought they were young girls and then turned out to be, like, trans masculine.
Yeah.
I've heard about a lot of that going around in like the Supernatural fandom, the Teen Wolf fandom.
Oh, that's not surprising. I feel like that happens a lot when you deal with situations of like cross gender identification with characters.
Yes. Yeah, I guess the gay shipping thing. Yeah. I mean, we've talked about it before, but yes.
And I'm sure we'll talk about it plenty more.
Plenty more.
Down the road. But we're not there yet.
Not yet.
Not yet, but when that day comes. Welcome back to the First Risk Podcast, everybody. I am your host, who is who voted early with his absentee ballot, Ryan Kearns.
I am your host, who voted like 2 hours ago because I'm a procrastinator, Jane Mulcahy. And also, we release these episodes like 2 weeks after recording them, so this is going to be really dated.
So
by the time we post it. But for the record, it is election day as we are recording this.
At the time of recording, we do not know who the president is going to be. We do not know who the president-elect is going to be. And so this is our last little hurrah of not knowing and biting our little nails that man does not get back in office.
It's the election day special. And election. I worry that this entire episode is going to be like drenched in dramatic irony no matter what happens.
Yeah.
But, you know, what can you do?
I saw this tweet that was like trying to have conversations with people today while we're not freaking out about the big thing that's happening.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going around.
Yeah. My restaurant's been really dead recently because everyone's just been on edge about the election. Mm. Like yesterday, I think I had maybe like 7 tables total over like a 6.5 hour shift.
Mm-hmm.
And like the tables that were there, I like went up to them and I asked them, how are you guys doing today? And they're like, oh, you know,
coping.
Can we get the baked meatballs? Like
drowning your sorrows in some meatballs for
sure.
Oh
my god.
I'm getting drunk tonight, Ryan. That's all I know.
I'm getting so drunk tonight. I don't have work tomorrow. I'm gonna be so hungover.
Honestly.
I've been seeing this guy for a couple of weeks, and so we're gonna hang out tonight after I get off work and just like get smashed and eat dinner and watch a movie and just like try not to think about anything.
I'm going to like an election night, not party, but kind of a get together.
Oh, nice.
So it's going to be like all election night. But I mean, honestly, like I don't enjoy because it's so nerve wracking, but I do find it kind of exciting to like watch the results come in.
Mm-hmm. No, I do too. I do too.
Yeah. I come from that kind of family, I guess, that's very like politics. My dad was a political editor on the radio. So.
Oh, nice.
It's always a big event for us.
I just remember like the trauma of like being 16 and like sitting in like my high school green room, like after rehearsals for the show we were in, which was Chicago, and like we were sitting there, like watching, like state after state. It's 2016, state after state turned red and red. Virginia's red, Pennsylvania's red. It's all red. It's all red. It's all red. And we're like, oh no, she's losing all these battleground states. Oh no, 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 no.
Yeah, my mom and I had gone out to dinner that night because, like, you know, we all just thought that Hillary was going to win. So we were like, yeah, this is chill. We'll go out to dinner. And we came back home and started watching the news. And it was like, oh, this is not going our way. And then I went to like a hippie Montessori high school where like everybody was woke and gay.
I've heard of those. So,
yeah, you know, it happens. So, like, the next day going into school, everybody was, like, including myself, like, it was bad. Everybody was in the dumps.
I grew up in a very blue area, like, a very comfy sort of liberal area. And so, like, being, being, like, Republican was, like, super taboo. Owning guns was super taboo. And so, like, you could totally snuff out, like, exactly who was really, really happy about it. Just by like walking around and seeing who didn't look completely devastated.
Damn.
There was this one guy I had in my civics class, because I had civics that year. There was only like two conservative guys in the class, and one of them was like from this like super super right wing family. His dad told him to wear a MAGA hat the next day.
Oh my god.
And like he walked in and he had this bright smile on his face. And it was like, did you ever see The Producers, like, from the 60s?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, at the end of...
Oh, my God, Ryan. Telepathy? What? Because literally as I was casting my ballot, I had, not from the 60s version, but I had I Want to Be a Producer from the musical version of The Producers stuck in my head for some reason.
Oh, my God.
So it's a producer's kind of day.
It's a producer's kind of day. And he walked in, and I swear to God, it was, like, at the end of Springtime for Hitler when that one guy claps and everyone starts, like, beating him up. Yeah,
I feel like if there had been a guy like that at my school, it would have, we were like, because everybody was so woke and gay, it was a very peaceful place, but like, that probably could have been like the first physical fight at our school.
All right, do we want to set the state, the America Decides aside for the next hour and talk about 911?
I guess we should, although I wouldn't be surprised if it ends up popping up throughout this discussion anyway.
Yeah, it probably
but
will.
Yes, on to season one, episode five, Point of Origin.
So we open with a very, I think at the time it was topical, because there was a big viral video and a news, this is like a ripped right from the headlines call.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, so there's this Indian wedding that's happening in LA. Mm-hmm. These Indian families, there's an arranged marriage happening between a very handsome young man and a very beautiful young woman.
Like, Prem and Savita.
Can we just say the most gorgeous people on the planet is this couple?
I guess I hadn't really taken note of that, but sure.
It's like, it's just a very like TV thing. Like, oh, we're having this like random marriage with these random characters, and they just happen to be played by like just two like physically perfect people.
Yeah, I just feel like that's basically always how it is on TV.
Yeah, and she has like nerves about the wedding, and he has nerves about the wedding because obviously they don't know each other that well. It's, you know, it's arranged by their families, but they're going in with open minds. Their friends are encouraging them. And it's a very beautiful ceremony. She looks gorgeous in her dress. It's all traditional. And then at the reception, everyone's dancing on the dance floor. And then it collapses and a lot of people die.
Yes, the entire floor falls through. As the 118 get there, I'm pretty sure Buck says like 16 DOA, which I took note of is just like, wow, that's a lot. Like that would be a major disaster.
Yeah. They fall through like two stories and like down,
two stories.
Yeah. Down to the ground floor. It's like a nightmare.
Yeah. They can't find the bride, which is really distressing. But eventually they find her under some rubble. They get her out. She seems okay. Bobby gets very personally angry about all this. He finds the building owner, like walks up to him, starts shoving him around. He's like, did you know that this material has been outlawed for years? This floor used to be the roof, didn't it? And then you added a story. He's like really going in.
Really going in, like uncharacteristically, like enraged at this like cheapskate landlord. And obviously it's laying the seeds for something we find out later, but it's just his like dark Bobby era, because he's still obviously like he fell off the dark wagon last Bobby. episode, and he's struggling and he's having a difficult time. And Hen and Buck are very sort of taken aback by his behavior here, especially Hen.
Hen's trying to like talk him out of it, and she's like, just last night or whatever, yesterday you were saying help, which of course brought me back to Bobby's delivery of the line help. But yeah, so he's clearly, it hasn't been long since the events of the last episode, so he's kind of still going through it, it seems.
Right. I just want to say for our listeners, they are doing construction in my building. So if you get any drilling noises in your headphones, just know it's not you. It's me.
Ryan lives in a very noisy place.
Yeah.
There's always something going on in the background of your audio.
No, seriously, there is. It's a nightmare. part of the reason I don't make videos more often is because recording is just such an absolute nightmare. Oh, and there's police sirens.
That's okay. It, like, puts us into the setting. It's immersive.
Yeah, it's thematically appropriate, you know?
Yeah, just pretend that's the 118.
What do we think about this opening call? I think it's a pretty effective way to start off, especially because it's a very sensational story. And I remember this because I was still on Facebook when the news broke about a similar story happening that I think inspired this episode. And so I saw all this, like, outpouring of, like, concern on Facebook over this and, like, rage at, like, the building not being up to code, and it was, like, a big thing on, like, CNN or whatever. I think when I watched this for the first time, when I was watching it through for the first time back in the day, I think I clocked this too, and I was like, oh, I guess we are doing the sort of rip from the headlines thing, because I think this is, like, the first one where they really sort of based it off of, like, a specific event.
Right.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that is...
There were probably some others. Like, probably you could argue, like, the bouncy house thing.
Yeah.
Probably directly inspired by at least a couple specific events, but yeah.
I just remember how viral the video was of that happening. I think I saw it in, like, a Vine compilation at one point. Like, it bled over into, like, entertainment YouTube.
God.
Which is horrible, but it's, like, it's also kind of, like, just telling.
Yeah. I kind of wish that someone would, like, take note. I wish, like, in the IMDb trivia or whatever, you could find, like, exactly which events inspired each call in an episode. Like, somebody should make a database for that, because I think it's really interesting, but it's kind of hard to know exactly unless, like, you were, like, already aware of the thing that happened.
Yeah. I think my only other thought about this call, before we move on, because this is a very character-focused episode, so there's not a whole lot of time spent on the calls. The rubble that they use, the way that they set up the rubble, was, to me, very reminiscent. And obviously, it's not, like, reminiscent because it's, like, this happened after, but it was reminiscent of the rubble effect they used in the opening, like, the cold open of Teen Wolf the movie. And when Scott's, like, saving
You're
that little
wrong.
Girl from, like, that building collapsing.
Yeah, with the dog.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, oh, wow. Okay. Similar production values.
But we cut from that to Athena and Hen having a little hangout. They're having drinks together at a bar.
Mm-hmm. And they're basically sort of debriefing each other on everything that's been going on. You know, May's back at home. We didn't really see a resolution to the sort of the CPS thing.
Right. But I guess it's over. they talk a little bit about the whole thing with, is her name Layla, the child that Athena's been harassing?
Yeah, Layla. Actually, I think I might have missed it because I had to put on subtitles halfway through this scene. So, like,
Well, basically, she says that the parents are willing to kind of drop their complaint as long as Athena drops the charges against their daughter, which Athena's not happy about. But if it can get her off of desk duty, fair enough. And Hen's telling her about Bobby, which I found this interesting, just, like, knowing what's going to happen between Athena and Bobby. It's kind of interesting to see her talking about him before she really knows him that well.
Yeah.
I wanted to point out she refers to Bobby as both Clark Kent and Bruce Wayne at various points throughout this conversation. So I guess, which I thought was interesting, because, like, the Clark Kent thing I can kind of understand. They're trying to set Bobby up as, like, he's a good old-fashioned, big, tall, strong guy.
Yeah.
There was a line in the previous episode where I think it was Tatiana refers to Bobby as Gary Cooper. She's like, oh, now I see why they call you Gary Cooper, which is an interesting reference.
Right.
But I love, because I love Gary Cooper.
I think maybe the Bruce Wayne thing came out about, like, maybe his, like, his mood shift into, like, the sort of,
right,
I guess, his,
you're right, because I was gonna say, like, I feel like it doesn't make that much sense to compare him to both Clark Kent and Bruce Wayne, but I guess, yeah, it's like the duality of Bobby.
Yeah, his little Jekyll and Hyde moment. And then, of course, we also get the lesbian confirmation with Hen, and this is the first time
we hear
on
about
the
her
show
wife for the first time.
This is the first time on the show that they've ever actually spoken about not just Hen's home life, but also the fact that, you know, she's married to a woman and she has a son. And like, mm-hmm. I remember watching this the first time through and like I was like craving some gays, right? Mm-hmm. Other than Michael, of course. And when that happened, it was like that fucking scene in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood where Leo sits up in the seat.
You're pointing at the TV.
Yeah, seriously, I was. And so it was interesting that it took them until episode 5 to confirm Hen's sexuality. But
I guess they just didn't have an opportunity to drop that into conversation before.
This is such a weird question. But and obviously, like this show, like, it doesn't really need this conversation because it's good about this in a lot of ways. But mm-hmm. Does this scene specifically pass the Bechdel test?
Ooh, no. I think no, because they're talking about Bobby for much of it.
Yeah.
But also, like, what a lot of people don't understand about the Bechdel test is it's not like an actual litmus test for everything you watch. It's just like a fun thought experiment created by Alison Bechdel in a Dykes to Watch Out For comic in the 90s. It's not that serious. And you get people online, like male critics often, not even critics, like YouTubers is what I really mean.
Yeah.
Who will be like, ew, like, why does things have to pass the Bechdel test? And it's like, it doesn't. Nobody said that. Only you said that. Nobody thinks about it that way. It's literally just a thing from a comic strip. And if anything, it was more about lesbians than it was about like general feminism in movies originally. So it's often taken out of context. Not that that's what you were implying, but just to clear it up for our listeners.
No, thank you.
I feel like the average like smart movie watcher, TV watcher these days probably already knows that lore.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's basically, a scene can still be good to women and good at feminism without technically passing the Bechdel test.
Oh, yeah, I think this is a good example of that. You know, it's all about sort of, I guess, Hen and Athena's friendship. Obviously, you know, Aisha and Angela have great chemistry, and it's just giving voice to both of their lives. And it's just two women having an inner world and sharing that with each other over some drinks. Like, I don't see anything about that wouldn't be feminist.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Definitely. So another piece of information we get here is that Hen's ex has reached out to her ex Eva, who I was kind of impressed by how well they exposited everything in this scene, because it doesn't feel like they're just like dumping information on you or like saying it in a clunky way, but they actually give you like a lot of exposition here where they establish that Hen is married and has a child specifically who is adopted from her ex Eva, who she has a strained relationship with and who is now in prison. Mm-hmm. So like you get all of that just from like a pretty natural conversation.
Yeah, because you're hearing it over drinks, you know, it feels like you're having a drink with them basically when you're hearing about their lives like this.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they're bringing you into their world.
Yeah, I just remember thinking there was like a very deft line, I thought, where like Athena, she manages to like communicate all that information in like one or two lines where she's like, and how does Karen feel about that? Like your wife, I don't know, something about like, how does she feel about your ex wanting to talk to you from the pokey or something? Like she just gets it all out in one line, but it doesn't feel like super info dumpy. So
Maybe that's to Angela's strength as well. Maybe that's to her strength as an actor, that she's able to deliver exposition in a way that feels very naturalistic.
True. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it is like serious, like bombshell information. It's like Hen has a kid, has a wife. X is coming back into the picture from prison.
Has a crazy ex who's in prison. Yeah.
And is also, I don't think we learn this right away, but Eva is also Denny's biological mother.
Yes. Well, I feel like it's kind of, they even kind of communicate that in this scene. It's maybe not entirely clear, but there's a line where Hen says, I think, like, she was okay with us adopting Denny or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they do at least get at that in this scene already.
Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of like almost like a textbook example of like a good way to deliver a lot of exposition about a character without making it feel heavy-handed, while making it feel naturalistic and making it feel like you're being drawn into the world rather than having the world thrown at you almost.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's well done. And then we go from that to Buck. We get some of his inner world for the first time.
Buck's frat house.
Buck lives in a fucking frat house.
Jesus it is Christ. Wild. Like, he is not in college. None of his friends, I don't think, are in college. His roommates, I mean. And no. yet they live in what is, like, clearly textually a frat house. Yeah. It's, like, full of red Solo cups are everywhere. He walks in and his roommate's, like, what is he, like, playing video games with some girl?
Yeah, the girl's over and they're like, oh, this is, the place this is our just friend filthy. Buck. That's a disaster.
Shout out to the set deck of this scene specifically, because they paint a very vivid picture of it's just like covered in like dirty dishes and yeah, the red Solo cups and like pizza boxes. But I have to say, Buck as a 26-year-old living in a frat house, very embarrassing.
Very embarrassing. Opinion. And honestly makes a lot of sense. Like when you see like everything he does on the show up to this point and then you see this, it's like, oh,
he's that kind of person. It's like, I'm not saying like at 26 you may very well still be living with lots of roommates, you might not have like a super amazing living situation, yeah. But like frat house is rough.
Yeah, because like, don't get me wrong, like I live in an apartment of four other guys, like there have definitely been nights when we have had kind of like what you might consider a fratty vibe, but like we don't like we all do our chores, right? We all
four clean. Other guys. I didn't know this about you.
Oh yeah, lore drop. I live in an apartment with four other guys in East Harlem. We have two bathrooms. We all have our own room. It's great. We have a big living room.
Do you all sleep in one bed like the grandparents in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory?
We do. Yeah, we cuddle up and we take shifts, like who gets to be whose boyfriend for the week. It's like very much like a poly situation.
Of course, and this is the only way you can afford rent in New York.
Yes, of course. But it's actually been bad because Rainbow has been gaslighting Sock about doing the dishes for months. Yeah, no, but like on the one hand, like I can like somewhat relate to Buck that this is a very like 20s situation, but like mm-hmm. there's a line, right? There's a line.
At 26, you've got to start doing your dishes, though, I think is the line.
Yeah, 100%. You got to sweep, you got to vacuum, you got to mop, you got to clean the bathroom.
You got to buy real glassware instead of using those red Solo cups.
And then you have to wash them.
That's probably why they use the red Solo cups, so they don't have to wash them.
You live in LA, you have a dishwasher, presumably, especially in a house like this. You probably have a garbage disposal. Like, you have so many tools that you...
He doesn't know how to use either one of those.
He doesn't know how to...
Buck is one of those people, he's like Googling how to turn dishwasher on.
He can do anything, he just has to be showed how to do it once.
Garbage disposal, where is it?
I just want to mom this guy. I want to mom him so hard. I want to like get his life in order. Do you think he knows how to do his own laundry? That's the question.
Season 1, Buck 1.0, I'm not 100% sure he does.
Laundry, and like, I feel like he would like, you would give him like an iron to like iron his uniform. He'd be like,
why do I need this?
He would just press it to his skin, like
burn himself immediately.
But then he gets home. Obviously, it's a very noisy place. It's a very chaotic spot. It's hard. I presume it would be hard to like unwind and focus and everything.
Wait. One more thing, roasting Buck about his frat house. Isn't it kind of a surprise that he doesn't just sleep on a mattress on the floor? That he has a real bed frame?
Yeah.
That would have been one more detail to really sell it.
Yeah. I'm surprised his floor isn't dirtier. I feel like he'd be the kind of person to walk around barefoot, and then he gets that like foot seasoning from when you don't sweep.
Oh, God.
You know what I mean?
Not seasoning.
But then, you know, he goes up to his room and he gets a text from Abby, and it's like a spam text because we found out later she sends it to all of her contacts, but it's a flyer. It's a missing persons flyer for her mom, who, as we know, walked out the house and didn't walk back in.
Yes. So he immediately calls Abby. Abby and Carla are kind of frantically bustling around the house, trying to figure out how to track down Patricia, which is her mom's name, which we couldn't remember in one of our last episodes. So Buck's like, you know, are you okay? What's going on? And he kind of, once he hears what's going on, he immediately is like, I'm coming over and I'm going to help look for your mom.
And this is the first time Buck is going to have seen Abby, and obviously this is the first time they'll have seen each other in person. She knows what he looks like. He doesn't know what she looks like, so this is going to be interesting. And we'll find out what happens with that in a moment. But right after that, it switches to Hen going to visit Eva at the prison.
Yes.
And it's
Eva with the cornrows.
Eva with the cornrows and the prison jumpsuit, giving a little Orange Is the New Black. Okay.
If you consider any story about prison giving Orange Is the New Black.
Only women in prison. White women with cornrows in prison. Their reunion is very tense, right? There is a very palpable tension between the two of them, but not like a hatred or a despise. It's like a jilted lover's tension. Obviously, you know, Eva greets Hen by calling her baby.
Yeah, you can just tell that, like, however they left things was not very good. Obviously, I mean, Eva's in prison. I'm not trying to imply that Hen, like, put her in prison, but yeah. Eva's kind of seemingly trying to, like, pick up where they left off a little bit. Hen's not having that. She's like, I'm married. You know, at one point, Eva says, like, you don't want to, like, catch up with your girl. Hen's like, you're not my girl.
Yeah.
Eva tries to ask about Denny, who is Hen and her wife's son. But, you know, Hen doesn't really want to tell her much about him. It's, like, not really her business now that he's been adopted.
We find out that Denny's full first name is actually Diesel.
Well, do you think that's, like, his full name or just, like, what Eva has called him?
It might be what she called him. I think it would be, like, just based on the slice of her life that we get from this, like, I think it would be in character for her to be like, let me name my son Diesel, and then Hen to be like, we're gonna call him Denny.
Yeah, I guess she does have the line where she says, we call him Denny now. I don't think she says his name is Denny. That's wild if Denny's legal name is Diesel.
Yeah, his government name.
Well, anyway, it turns out the purpose of Eva's doing this, asking Hen here, is that she's up for release soon because, like, good behavior, it sounds like. Yep. And she's been trying hard. She's been, like, taking some accounting courses. She's, like, ready to get back in the workforce, and she needs somebody to vouch for her at her hearing, I think.
Yeah.
So she's asking Hen if she could kind of play the upstanding firefighter and vouch for her, but Hen is a little hesitant about this.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where we leave things.
Yeah. Eva wants her to, like, come in her uniform and everything and sort of, like, basically perform a sort of, like, testimony on behalf of, like, a city official, right? That, like, this is an upstanding member of the community. She is fit for release. Get her out of that cell.
Yeah.
You know, and they haven't seen each other in over a year. And so, like, you know, you can only imagine, like, the things running through Hen's mind seeing her again. She still obviously has an obvious sort of, like, affection for Eva and sort of a patience for her. Otherwise, she wouldn't be here and she wouldn't be, like, having this conversation with her. But, like, she walks away from this seemingly considering it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like you said, that's sort of where we leave it, on that sort of ambiguous note. Then we go from that right back to Carla is at Abby's. There's a knock at the door. She answers it. Buck appears and Carla melts.
Well, there's a great moment here where where Buck sees Carla and goes, Abby?
You know, there was totally, like, a thought running through Carla's mind, like, yes, that's me. Hello,
what
handsome.
If I just ran with this?
But then, of course, the camera pans over. Abby appears.
Abby in her cute little overalls.
Her cute Loved little her overalls. Outfit in this episode. Yes, and, like, the glasses with them too. Very farmer core.
And, like, the messy hair, like, very giving, sort of like Wattpad protagonist. Mm-hmm.
Very, like, sort of like.
Just like, oh, I'm just thrown together today.
A little Stardew Valley core, even.
Sure.
And, you know, this is Buck's first time seeing Abby, and he gets this little look on his face, but they have business to do, so they can't focus on that right now.
Right. They get right into tracking down Abby's mom. Yeah. Abby has kind of, with her 911 dispatcher powers, she's kind of figured out all these things, like, this is the mile radius we need to look in.
She's, and it's incredible that she's made, like just, like, a map of, like, all the possible routes based on, like, the time elapsed, which is, like, 9 hours, and her mom's calculated 3 mile per hour walking speed.
Yeah, they have a funny line where, you know, Carla's like, Patricia is an annoyingly fast walker.
and they have this like this like just like this great just sort of like this like radius of like possible places to where she could be, and they just commit to spending the day checking everywhere. They're like,
yeah.
Buck's like 1 mile at a time, and you see in Abby's eyes like, oh, he's right. Arrived.
I do like I was thinking when they were on the phone earlier and Buck was just like immediately like, okay, I'm coming over to help you. Like even back then with Buck 1.0, I feel like he was always just like ready to help someone at the drop of a hat, you know, even if it's kind of inconvenient for him or even if it's someone he doesn't know that well. And I feel like that's one of the reasons we love Buck, you know, it's just in his nature.
He's a really good person, you know, and he's just kind and giving and generous and so handsome and, you know.
He's got those giant arms.
Got those big arms and that just that cute birthmark. Oof.
Despite living in a frat house. The fact that he lives in a frat
Remember the frat house. Remember the frat house. Remember the probably can't do laundry. It's okay.
From there, we cut right to Bobby in church.
Yeah, right from there.
We all could use the visit to church right now.
Yes, we could. Let's feel the healing, warm presence of the Lord.
I'm reining it in.
Reining it in. And speaking of gay people, the gay priest is back, and we're in the pews with Bobby and Homotron,
hot gay priest,
and he's struggling with whether to, I guess, trust his team with sort of like the truth of his past. You know, he's saying like, you know, they've given me so much of themselves, and I've given them nothing in return, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the priest asks, like, what are you hiding from them? What are you holding back? And he goes, says this in the craziest possible way that he could. He goes, that I murdered my own family.
Which, once again, I just have to call us back to the Degrassi episode where Eli Goldsworthy says to Claire, this is where I killed my girlfriend. Because exactly the same energy.
Yeah.
We like cut to the reaction shots of Claire and Hot Priest, respectively.
Jeez, you don't gotta say it like that, man. You're making it worse for yourself. You don't gotta say it like that. So now what
happened?
Well,
okay. From there, we cut to huge Bobby flashback. This is much of the episode.
Yeah.
Cut to Bobby in his car. Title card: St. Paul, Minnesota. 5 years ago.
How do you feel about the rep?
Oh, I love it. You know, I love it. I just love to see St. Paul in the movies, in the television, anytime.
Mm-hmm.
I guess this isn't like the best. Well, all we see of St. Paul is them having a terrible building that isn't up to code that catches on fire and kills a ton of people.
Glowing endorsement for your beloved
not
city.
Every building in St. Paul is like that.
Right. Yeah, yeah. No, it seems like a great place. I can't wait to visit at some point.
I just voted on two city questions for St. Paul. So we flash back to St. Paul, Minnesota, hometown in which I still live.
5 years prior.
5 years ago.
I don't know why, but I thought the fire was more recent. I guess because Bobby had moved to LA more recently or something like that. I think he moved to LA.
Yeah,
like...
he mentions at one point that he spent like 1 or 2 years after the fire, like, living on pills and vodka, so I guess he was like kind of just stayed in St. Paul like on a bender for a while. Mm-hmm. I mean we'll get more context in like his Bobby Begins Again episode in season 2, but yeah, I also kind of misremembered that. I wasn't sure it was that long ago.
Yeah, but it was fully 5 years ago. This is kind of like, I guess, the predecessor to all of the Begins episodes, because this is the first time we're actually taking like a significant chunk out of an episode to spend some time with the character's past.
Yeah, definitely.
So approaching it from that, I guess, angle, I have more of a patience for it. I already told you that I normally kind of hate flashbacks as a narrative device, just because I feel like they always slow the momentum of an episode or a film or whatever to like a complete dead stop.
Mm-hmm.
But I think here, because it's such a character-focused episode already, I think it works better. And I think this show generally handles it better than most.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's such a like fast-paced, sensational show in general, and like the flashbacks are no different. I feel that, I don't mind a flashback. It's all about execution for me.
Yeah.
So in this one, we have Bobby is sitting in his truck alone, drinking. You said truck. That doesn't bode well.
You said truck, and I thought of Dear Evan Hansen. A real live truck.
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 Is there another truck come into our driveway?
There's not another truck coming to our driveway.
A real life truck. Okay, we can't get too sidetracked. Can't get too sidetracked. Am I right?
Sidetracked. No, we can't. Miss Julian. I just love the way that she hits the T and the K too. It's just the
truck.
The perfect way of saying truck.
Anyway, Bobby, I don't even really know that it was a truck. I think he was sitting in a truck. Whatever.
It was St. Paul, probably a truck, you know. But he
goes inside. Yeah. We see he had a wife. He had a wife and two young children.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He, you know, is kind of getting his kids ready for bed. He kisses his wife when he walks in, and you can tell that she immediately, like, smells something on him or can tell that he's off in some way.
Yeah.
He's getting ready for bed with the kids, and he like falls asleep while like sitting on the toilet next to them.
Yeah.
So we're getting some kind of red flags already. He puts the kids to bed. They're like adorable kids.
Oh my God.
A great relationship.
The most
with.
Adorable kids in the entire world. She's talking about, did you know that the best car to get hit by is an ambulance?
Yeah.
You know?
The best place to get robbed is inside a police station.
Right? And it's like, yeah, like the best place to get shot is in a hospital. Yeah, yeah, totally.
Well, she has a line where Bobby says something like, where'd you get that big, beautiful brain? And she says, probably Target. Must have been, I don't know if they were trying to like set the scene in Minnesota, since like Target is a Minnesotan company.
Yeah.
But they must have had Targets in LA by 2018.
Oh, 100%. We had Targets everywhere growing up in Washington. So they're big on the West Coast.
But like, I want to believe that that was supposed to be a Minnesota thing. I also got my brain at Target. I love it there.
After he puts his kids to bed, you know, he has a little moment with his son. His son's kind of concerned for him, but he goes lights out. And he has a talk with his wife, and we sort of learn. And this is, I think this exposition was handled a bit more clumsily than the hen and Athena scene.
Sure. Which exposition do you mean? The back thing?
I mean the back thing primarily. We learn that Bobby has chronic pain because he broke his back about 5 years ago, which explains why he sort of self-medicates with booze, and he uses this like excuse of like going on walks at night to drink and to take pills and all this stuff, right?
Yeah, he mentions that, you know, his wife kind of approaches him like, I'm thinking maybe we should go to another doctor about your back. He says, you know, they say a broken back never really heals, which I think this is interesting because I feel like they kind of forget at some point in the show that he initially started using because of chronic pain, because I feel like that never comes back again, like
ever.
Ever. Or the fact that he broke his back. Yeah, so that's interesting. Like, I wonder, like, does he still have struggle with pain management, or is that just like that was just an excuse and it actually got better and he was just using anyway because he was addicted? I don't know.
I guess by this point in the timeline, like in the modern day, it has been a decade since he broke his back.
Right.
So it's probably,
but he said a broken back never really fully heals.
That's true. I mean, my back is kind of fucked up right now, so that's probably true.
I hope you didn't break it.
No, definitely not. Just like a little bit of a strain because I was, I had some bad form on some hack squats and I was kind of overloading. So it was just, don't do 300 pounds on hack squats unless you are very, very, very convinced that you have the form down to a T.
Oh, I do not intend to.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Bobby says, I'm going out for my walk.
Yeah.
And the wife seems to kind of know what that means, but you know, she can't stop him. So he goes to his little secret drug den, which is like another room in the apartment building.
It's like three kind of floors bare. Down. Like three floors down.
I think it's room like 306 or 308. Or no, like 608. I forget. So, whatever.
I think it was 608. Yeah, I think it was. Yeah.
Yes. So he goes into his little drug den. He's like got a space heater in there.
Because he doesn't pay the utilities in that apartment, obviously, because it's too expensive to have two apartments. He just pays the rent on it.
Yeah, they also mentioned it's like in the deep midwinter. You know, it's like super cold out, his wife mentioned.
Yeah.
Classic St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey. Actually, if this took place 5 years before 2018, so 2013... this could have been around the time of what they called the polar vortex in Minnesota. This was a whole thing where, like, it got unbelievably cold for several days during the winter of, I think it might have been 2014.
How cold
but
are we talking?
I remember they canceled school, not because of snow, but because it was so cold.
Like, because they were, like, concerned people would, like, freeze.
Yeah, like, because it wasn't safe to travel, basically, because of how cold it was. Yeah, no, the polar vortex, our first one, I'm pretty sure, was in 2014, but then we had, like, several more polar vortexes.
Negative 55?
Yeah, dude, it was bad.
What the fuck happens in your state?
I'm telling you, I was in, like, seventh grade, and they canceled a ton of school for, like, a week or two.
Whoa.
Because you just couldn't go outside. I had a dog at the time, and I would, like, take him... like, not even around the block, just to, like, the end of the block and back for his walk, because, like, we couldn't be outside for any longer than that.
No kidding. Jesus Christ. And looping it back to St. Paul of the show's universe, in order to beat the cold...
Feel free to cut as much or as little of that polar vortex sidebar as you want.
Well, it's important context, because in order to beat the cold, Bobby uses both a gas lamp and a mm-hmm. space heater.
Yeah. And he's also, like, sloppily pouring liquor into a flask, you know, so kind of getting that everywhere.
Yeah.
He accidentally, like, falls asleep while he's doing this.
He has the heater next to these, like, seemingly, like, very flammable drapes.
Yes.
Which is it's crazy. Kind of,
I wrote in my notes, it's kind of giving Final Destination again, where you're just getting all these little hints of, like, little dangerous things or things that could go wrong.
If I could, like, link it to anything specifically, it would be the girls in the tanning beds in Final Destination 3.
Mm-hmm.
Just by the way, it's fucking setting this up.
Well, I was thinking more of the teacher in FD1 who, she has, like, the most, like, Rube Goldberg kind of death in the movie, where, like, they're showing you a ton of little hints of all these different things that could happen.
Yeah.
And one of them is she's, like, really nervous because she is scared that death is coming to get her. And she's, like, pouring vodka into a mug, and mm-hmm. it's a mug with a crack in it. So she's walking along in her house, and it's, like, dripping, leaving this trail of drips of vodka.
Mm-hmm.
And then she spills a little bit in, like, her computer or printer or something, and you see the sparks. And then eventually a fire starts, and you see it, like, light the trail of vodka drips along her floor. So that's what this was reminding me of.
And obviously it ends in, like, the big knife moment.
Yes. Once again, similarly to the Glee thing, if we don't talk about Final Destination at least once per episode, we'll also die.
We'll wither and die, yes.
But Bobby accidentally falls asleep during this little ritual, and when he wakes up, it's, like, been a couple of hours. And so he comes back to his apartment, his wife's asleep on the couch, she clearly was waiting up for him, so this looks bad.
Yeah.
He wakes her up, kind of tries to explain himself, but she already knows, she's figured it all out, she is really upset. They have this little talk about it. He's doing, I think, an interesting thing. Like, I liked the way they depicted kind of where his mind is at, like, in the throes of this addiction, where you can tell he's really still trying to, like, rationalize it all to himself and to his wife. He says some interesting things. He seems to still believe that he has it under control. He says at one point, he's like, I'm Superman. I go into burning buildings and come out without a scratch. You know, it's like he's doing this sort of self-aggrandizing thing,
mm-hmm.
like, addiction-wise, to, like, convince himself that he doesn't really have a problem.
Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting.
It was, and it was really realistic. I've known many an addict in my day, and sort of the self-rationalization and sort of the defensiveness is obviously, you know, sort of a mm-hmm. very real space to be in, especially when you know that you have a problem, but you're not ready to admit it, or you're not willing to admit that, especially you've fallen off the wagon after working so hard to get back on it. You know, he mentioned that he'd been to rehab a year prior.
There's so much, like, sleight of hand to, like, try and keep it from loved ones. So I feel like, you know, he's been doing all these things.
Yeah.
He's got, like, these rituals to basically try and cover it up, like going on his little walk and stuff. And, you know, the wife brings up a lot of very fair points. She's like, have you been driving our kids to school high? Yeah. And apparently he has.
Well, which, you know, he absolutely has been. Absolutely.
Yeah. So she actually, honestly, you know, says a very understandable thing. She's like, I just need you to get out tonight. Like, I can't. I love you and I'm going to forgive you, but, like, I can't deal with you tonight.
Yeah.
And she's like, spend the night in your drug den or whatever.
Yeah. It's interesting that she sort of, the way that this aesthetically mirrors the way a lot of, like, similar scenes in other media happens, where a wife confronts a husband about an affair, right? And sort mm-hmm. of the way that breaks up a marriage and breaks up a family. But this addiction is sort of like a chronic problem that they're working, like, multiple years, obviously, to sort of work through mm-hmm. together at, for the sake of their kids, for the sake of their marriage. Obviously, you know, she yeah. loves him very much still. And not only does he like have his schemes, but he has his schemes down to like a science. You know, he's mm-hmm. so practiced with it, where he has the yes. lamp ready on the counter, you know.
Yeah.
But even falling asleep, he rushes out of the drug den and he leaves the space heater on.
Ooh, yes. So Final Destination hint, he left the space heater on
yeah.
without thinking. I do want to say in this conversation, though, I just have a problem where I have trouble taking Peter Krause's performance seriously sometimes. Oh, no. And it's not that I think he's bad or anything. Mm-hmm. I think he just comes off a little like over the top to me in a way that I like as I've said many times, I love like the campy elements of this yeah. show, but like to me, and I think he's technically good, it's just he has this unique style. And I wanted to say there's just something about like the moments in this sort of conversation when he's like listing all of the things he does, or like the drugs he's started using, he just rattles them off in this sort of like really matter-of-fact quick way
yeah.
that I found kind of funny. He's like, yeah, well, my back started hurting again, I got a prescription, I started doing pills, and then I started drinking again. Like, I don't know, he's like not really giving it any like
it's like he was
weight.
It's like he was delivering his lines in the cadence of like Nicole Kidman in Being the Ricardos, like It was like an Aaron Sorkin joint scene. Like,
yeah, he's like Katharine Hepburn in Bringing Up Baby.
Right.
Oh my God.
Right.
I don't think it's bad, but like, and I've noticed he does this. Sometimes he's like a very quick, mm-hmm. he'll deliver dialogue very quickly in a way that kind of comes off as kind of silly to me. But I don't know. I just like, if you watch that argument back, there's something, it's also like with his little smirk on his face, it just mm-hmm. makes him seem like less serious. But again, not saying it's bad, just like a funny thing.
We can say
comes off funny to me.
We can say he's very theatrical. He's a very theatrical actor.
Yeah, but like in a way that I love. I also wanted to point out, I feel like he was doing a lot of the Bobby smirk in these conversations with mm-hmm. his wife.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Maybe it's just his natural resting state, and it's like Oliver Stark's accent, and he has to like train himself out of it.
So he kind of goes out again because his wife told him to spend the night somewhere else.
Yeah.
So he tries to go back to his drug den. He's like forgotten the key, so mm-hmm. he can't get in. So instead, he goes up to the roof, falls asleep drinking, taking pills on the roof.
Yeah.
Which, back to the polar vortex thing, that's what I thought was unbelievable, is like, damn, he would die. But I mean, he's drunk and high, so who knows.
Yeah, maybe that's he, like, keeping him warm inside.
Yeah, by the way, when his wife asks him what he's taking, he says, quote, everything. He says everything, just everything. Which, I'm sorry, not again, this is not like funny subject matter, but that also I was like, damn, everything.
Everything,
like, is he being literal?
Well, it's like, I don't know, I don't see any track marks on his arms, like it can't be everything. Like,
I think he's supposed to be just like exaggerating, but I thought it was kind of a funny thing for him to say.
I just like imagine what everything entails. Like, oh, he's smoking
every
some pot.
Single
like,
thing.
You know,
he's taking ecstasy. He's right. Heroin.
He's
taking opiates.
He's fucking
he's
going
drinking.
To a music festival and like doing acid with a bunch
drinking
of hippies.
Lean and
like
stuff.
Drinking lean. But then he wakes up a few hours later, and we get a 911 call in the flashback.
Yes, wild.
Wild.
Revolutionary.
Second 911 call of the episode, and it's in the flashback, and Bobby wakes up, buildings on fire, people are dying.
Yes, so he rushes back down to try and make sure his wife and kids are okay. He first, like, finds a man who's on fire, puts the fire out. He finds his family's apartment door, he kicks it in, and right as he kicks in the door, he and this man both fall through the floor.
Yeah.
Like, the floor gives out.
It collapses, yep.
Yeah, he's unable to check on his family. Some firefighters come in. They seem to recognize him. They're like, mm-hmm. Bobby, you got to get out of here.
Yeah.
He, you know, obviously is in, like, not only is he high and drunk, but he's, like, fully in his survival mode, got to save my family yeah. mode. So he's just, like, frantically yelling at these people. He's like, give me your gear.
Yeah, basically like begging them
gear.
To, like yeah. let him, like, go in there and, like, get his family out. It's, like, it's very tragic
yeah.
to watch, honestly.
It is. It's rough. And they have to, like, physically drag him out of there.
Yeah.
And I think that point is when we cut back to the present in the church. That's all we see of this flashback.
Yeah. And the gay priest asks him, like, why it happened. And, you know.
Well, first of all, the gay priest is wiping away tears, which I thought was a great detail. Like, what an empath.
What an empath. He chose the right profession.
Yes.
And he asks sort of, like, why it happened. And Bobby reveals, like nothing in the building was up to code. Obviously, this why he took everything so personally at the Indian wedding.
Yeah, the sprinklers didn't go off.
There was, like, asbestos in the walls, and it was made of, like, very shoddy material. Like, you know, I think there was, like, I don't know, like, electrical cables weren't hooked up properly or something like that. I don't know. It was, like, he spouted
basically
off
everything that could have been wrong was wrong.
Yeah, gas pipes were not insulated properly or something. I don't fucking know. It was just, like, it was, like, everything that could go wrong with the construction and management of a building did go wrong, and he didn't see it because he was always drunk and high.
Yeah.
And, like, he has a trained eye for it. Like, if he was soberer, one presumes he would have been able to see something and be like, maybe we should get an inspection going here. So he feels a sense of guilt over that.
He obviously blames himself, not only because his space heater was basically the inciting spark, which I don't think we technically mentioned, we hinted at it, but his space heater spark, some very funny looking CGI spark effects, you know. So in addition to him, like, literally technically being the start of the fire, he also just feels like had he been in his sound mind, he would have noted all of these problems with the building's fire safety.
Yeah. We find out 148 people died in the fire.
Including his wife and kids. Bobby has an insane line where he says he choked them on smoke and then burned their little bodies.
Which I'm sure is how it feels.
I'm sure it's how it feels. It's like, damn. Yeah. He is very tortured.
Very tortured. And honestly, you do see that in, like, the way that he sort of... his breakdown scene. I feel like those breakdown scenes are really hard to do, especially when, you know, I feel like male actors are always given the note to sort of, like, rein it in. You know what I mean?
And you think Peter is not reining it in?
No, I think he's letting it all out.
And good for him.
Good
for
him.
Bobby needs that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the priest is basically encouraging him, like, you know, you've been carrying this burden all by yourself. Like, you should just be honest with your coworkers. Yeah. Which makes Bobby emotional, but you kind of get the vibe that he is going to try that.
Yeah. The gay priest is correct. Yeah, he's correct about that.
Like, of course.
Yeah, you know, I don't think... I was going to say I don't think he has anything to be ashamed of. I don't know, but I don't know if that's true.
But it's like honesty is the best policy, he'll never get closer to his team without letting them in like this. Yeah. So.
Exactly. And it's like, it's the day that he stops standing in place and starts walking towards them and meeting them where they are. Yeah.
So we cut to Hen and her wife, Karen, at the playground watching their son, Denny, play.
Yes.
Our very first Karen Wilson appearance. Mm-hmm. Yas.
This episode marks the first appearance of Tracy Toms as
Tracy Toms'
one and only lesbian rocket scientist, Karen Wilson.
Literally.
Basically
the star of this show.
Yes. Yes.
I was like, I had, like, air horns going off in my head when she showed up in this episode.
Certainly the most...
like, finally.
Certainly the most deserving recurring cast member to be promoted to main cast. Hasn't happened yet.
Yes.
But
well, it's hard to say. I mean, she would have to get more involved with, like, the first responder stuff, I think.
Yeah.
And I also don't think it's, like, bad to have characters be in the background as long as they're, like, given adequate stuff.
Yeah, but, like, I mean, Albert was main cast for a season.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. If he gets one season of main cast, she should get one too.
It's like Karen becomes interim captain somehow.
How great would that be? I don't know. If Michael could
be
main cast.
I may not be a firefighter, but I am a rocket scientist.
If Michael could be main cast for all those seasons, Karen can get one.
I don't think Michael was main cast.
Was he not? Oh, I could have sworn he was.
I don't think he ever was. I would think he only was ever recurring, but I could be wrong.
Michael Grant. I'm looking this up right now. Yeah, Michael Grant is a former main character on 911, who is the ex-husband of Athena.
Okay, but that's not the same as... that's just like what his wiki says?
No, I'm telling you, he's main cast.
I don't believe that.
But okay. I mean,
like, was he billed as a main cast member?
Yeah, I'm going to the Wikipedia right now, because they have it listed. I know that May and Harry were also main cast for a while, and then
May makes sense to be main cast in the seasons where she becomes more of a.
Yep, Rockman Dunbar character. As Michael Grant, Athena's ex-husband, seasons 1-5.
Main cast, jeez. Yeah. Well, okay, if you say so.
Sixth
not trying
build.
To like be not trying to be mean to Rockman Dunbar. I just feel like his character did not seem like main cast.
Yeah, I mean, neither did Albert, but he got a season.
Like on his Wikipedia, it says main cast season 1-5, like all of his seasons. Yeah. That just does not make sense. It just doesn't.
Well, you know,
I mean, good for him if he was like being paid for that type of billing, but damn.
Yeah, but Karen's here. Hen and Karen are taking Denny to the park, and they're sitting on a bench watching him on the playground, as parents are often do.
So true.
They're having this little conversation because Karen wants Hen to I guess leave Eva in the cell, and Hen is kind of leaning more towards helping her out.
Yeah. I wanted to note, in terms of, like, the production design of this scene, Hen is wearing these, like, conspicuously dark sunglasses where you cannot see her eyes at all. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's reading too much into it, but I feel like that was a conscious choice on the part of the costumer to be, like, she's in this murky state of mind.
Ooh.
And, like, you know, she's, like, Karen can't quite trust her right now. And she's not really showing her hand completely. And so we can't see her eyes at all in this scene.
I don't know.
That was my thought.
No, I like that. I like that. It's like
maybe she was wearing the super dark sunglasses to communicate. Like she's not being totally forthcoming about her feelings towards Eva.
Yeah, she's being a little shady. So she's wearing her shades. Like,
so shout out to whoever made the decision to give her those super, super dark sunglasses.
Yeah. And it's a pretty brief scene. It's like a tertiary sort of introduction to Karen. But it is good to get Tracy Toms in the episode, and you find out more about.
Yes.
What you'd imagine Karen's feelings about Eva would be, which is.
She hates that bitch.
Keep her in a cage, like, you know?
Yeah, Hen has a line where she's like, she's not as bad as you think. And Karen says, she's worse.
She's worse, right. Yeah, so.
So from there, we cut to back to Buck and Abby. I almost said Buck and Eddie. No.
No, not yet.
Getting ahead of myself.
Yeah.
Buck and Abby. This is another kind of interestingly structured episode where, like, instead of, like, really cutting back between, like, A, B, and C plots in a really evenly distributed way, we have, like, opening, a couple, like, introductions, and then, like, huge Bobby flashback, and then we get back to everybody else's stuff.
Yeah, I gotta be honest, you know, I was sweet on it before just because I liked the character work that they were doing, but I'm not crazy about the structure of this episode. It just feels very, like, sort of disjointed and kind of poorly paced, in my opinion. Like, I really like the rhythm that they get into as the show goes along, where they sort of have an even spread, or at least a more even spread, because I feel like that helps keep things rolling. Whereas I feel like, I mean, like, I certainly, like, for a while, you sort of forget that, like, the thing with Patricia's happening, or, like, the specifics on everything with Hen and Eva, like, because, like, you're spending so much time with Bobby and his flashback. And, like, I don't know, like, all the stories are kind of equally interesting to me. So I want to spend an equal amount of time on them. I don't know. Maybe that's just me, but
yeah,
I don't know.
I don't think, like, it did not work for me, but yeah, I did kind of take note of this being a kind of weird way to structure it.
Yeah. So
Abby and Buck are in Buck's Jeep together. Yep. They're talking about looking for Patricia. They've got Athena on the line, like, keeping them updated if the police hear anything. They've also got one of those little
scanners.
Radios to, like, scanners to hear whatever calls come in on the, like, police radio, and
it's very
they
Styles
get
core,
to talking.
By the way,
very Styles core.
Yeah,
and Buck has this line that I took note of, where, you know, they're talking about how this is the first time they're really meeting each other, and he says, "Worst first date ever."
Yeah,
which reminded me of the previous episode being called "Worst Day Ever."
Mm.
It, you know, made me want to go, Buck, no, the title of the episode is "Worst Day Ever."
And then he just jumps right into, like, You haven't had sex in a year? Like,
he is so scandalized by hearing that she might not have had sex in not even like under a year.
Yeah.
And it's like, Buck, it's honestly not that crazy.
It's not. Stuff happens. Like, life gets
there are
him
some
away.
Great moments where, like, you know, she says, it's been a while since I've been on a date. And he says, what, like 2 weeks? Something like that.
Oh, God. He's such a goddamn menace. Buck 1.0. You will always be famous.
Like, Jesus Christ, Buck. Most people are not going on separate dates that often.
In
my, maybe I'm projecting. Maybe that's just speaking for myself.
I mean, like, I've certainly known some people who have. I can tell you from my experience, I like to, like, get to know people for kind of a substantial amount of time. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know.
Buck, though. Buck and Abby happen to hear on their little scanner a call come in about a downed power line that has electrified a pool where a little girl is stuck in the pool on like a pool floaty, so they decide to go help because they realize they're closer to it than the first responders coming to the rescue. And so they like run into these people's yard, and scary situation where you have this like got to be like 2 or 3 year old girl sitting on this big floaty in the middle of what you know is like a live charged pool. Some guy has jumped in to rescue her. They're like, is that the dad? And the mom says, no, that's the Manny. That poor Manny. He is dead as fuck.
Yeah. And she's, by the way, she's floating on like a giant slice of pizza, essentially. Like it's,
yeah, it's a pizza shaped floaty.
Yeah. Awesome.
They're trying to figure out what to do. The dad comes out of the house and tries to run to the pool.
Buck tackles
football tackles him as he is wont to do. Buck is always fucking tackling people.
Yeah.
Kind of one of his signature moves.
It's a crazy scenario, but it's also Abby's first time out in the field, and she gets this fucking, like, insane thing. And so she thinks fast, and she goes to the rubber hose that doesn't conduct
electricity.
Well, let us
just say that before she gets that idea, Buck picks up, like, a killer whale-shaped pool floaty.
Yeah.
And she's like, what are you doing? And he's like, I'm gonna ride this out to the middle of the pool, which doesn't make any sense. Because, like, his legs would definitely get into the water, but I love that was his first idea.
Maybe he'd be like one of those planking guys. Remember when planking was big?
Oh yeah, he's gonna plank on the pool floating
right above the water. Yeah, he definitely won't fall in.
The core strength for that.
Probably, but I just don't know that he has the balance or that floaty has the the fortitude.
Right. So thankfully, Abby is like, okay, we're not gonna fucking do that.
Yeah, we're not.
She walks over to the garden hose and snips off a big length of it, and they decide to, like, you know, Abby's on one side of the pool, Buck's on the other. They take the hose and, like, walk it over to the girl, have her grab onto it so that they can pull her to the edge of the pool, which is pretty smart. And they get her out of there. And then the firefighters arrive. They're able to turn off the electricity. I hope they were able to revive that Manny, because what an awful way to go.
5,000 volts in a pool of water. I don't know.
It's not looking good for him, people on this show have survived way crazier than that, if we're being honest.
He was floating.
It was probably only like a couple minutes.
Wasn't his eyes open, though?
Well, that doesn't mean anything. How many volts do you think pumped through Buck when he got struck by lightning? Spoilers.
You want this man
we
to
don't
be
have to keep that in.
You want this Manny to be alive so bad.
I felt bad because, like, the fact that he's the Manny, like, imagine dying over some dumbass job.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And
he's probably, like, from one of those agencies.
Yeah.
You know, my sister used to work for one of those. It's, like, not glamorous work. You're, like, underpaid to go look after kids for rich people, and then you die in a pool trying to rescue the kid you're taking care of.
I just know that if I was Buck and Abby, I would have been so pissed off that right as we finish this stunt, the fire department comes and turns off the power.
I thought that too. I was like, oh, you probably could have just waited.
But
who knows if they would have thought of the ingenious... I guess no, because they turned the power off. I was going to say, who knows if they would have thought of that great rescue, but I guess it wouldn't have mattered if they turned the power off.
It's like when you wait, like, for your opportunity to start jaywalking, and you get that perfect little gap in the cars, and then as you're walking, the light, like, turns, like, green on your end, so you could have walked anyways. It's like, oh, okay, great.
That's a very New York comparison for you to make. And congratulations on the fact that it's no longer illegal to jaywalk in New York.
Thank you very much. I got a hit tweet out of it.
Yeah, I noticed. A bunch of people getting angry at you in the comments.
It was actually my first non-Summerton related hit tweet.
Damn.
Yeah.
Congrats on that.
Thanks.
You don't need your legacy to be tied to that guy.
Thank God.
Your Twitter hit tweet legacy.
Thank God. I just thought the replies to that were so funny because it's like everyone's like, actually, cops use jaywalking as a way to criminalize Black people and harass them. I'm like, I know that. I know that. Like, it's the NYPD.
Who do you think I am? Yeah.
It's like, it was a joke, sweaty. Calm down. Like,
Twitter is like millions of the most humorless people in the world.
Seriously.
Getting together to try to experience jokes together. It's not a good mix.
It's okay. At least 400,000 people thought it was funny. So, you know, that's comforting. Yeah. That's comforting. We go from there to, we have this sort of scene where they're walking away from the call and Abby's sort of, she's riding the high of saving that little girl's life. And you sort of,
you
get to understand what they both see in each other, right? You know,
mm-hmm.
Abby's tied down with her mom. She says back in the car, like, it's hard to feel sexy with your mom dying in the living room or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And she's
drawn to Buck's reckless, daring, adventurous life, and he's drawn to her stability, it seems, because then in the car he actually says, I was looking at your hands earlier, mm-hmm. because, you know, when you deal with stuff like that, there's all this adrenaline, and my first few calls, my hands would be shaking like crazy, and your hands didn't shake at all, which I feel like is kind of a metaphor for, what he likes about her, that she's this stable, calm kind of person.
Yeah, I agree. It's a really good way to do this sort of, like, this kind of age gap relationship where you sort of tie it into first person to, say, age gap relationship in a way that's praising.
Give us more of this age gap relationship.
You actually tie it into, like, who they are as people and sort of, like, what they need in their lives and their lack and what they're finding in each other. It's like, you know, she finds this sort of youthful, sort of thrill-seeking lifestyle in Buck, and he finds this maturity in her, this stability,
Buck needs to come of age.
Yeah, it's exactly that. It's almost like a coming-of-age moment for both of them, where she's reclaiming her youth and he's coming into his maturity.
It's like both of what their strengths are in these two different periods of their lives, and how they're able to help each other. Kind of, dare I say, great written romance.
I would agree.
I did not anticipate that we would be such, like, Buck Abby stans,
right?
As we have been so far in this podcast. I think part of it is that we know that it's not a permanent thing. It's, like, kind of easier to just enjoy it.
Yeah.
Because we kind of know that the stakes aren't that high since it's not going to last forever. Yeah. It's like we're Abby in this situation. And we're like, well, this probably isn't my end game, but I'm just going to, like, enjoy this whirlwind while I can.
They're just stepping stones for each other. And honestly, that's kind of all they need to be, because, like, that's kind of where they are in their lives. It's sort of what they need. So, yeah, I think it really works. And honestly, it's like, it's making me wonder why the Buck Abby hate is so strong at all.
Yeah.
You know?
I wish I knew.
wish I knew. Why do people hate Abby so much? Could it be that they just hate women?
Well, then we get back
women?
To... So they get a call from... Yes.
Yeah.
They get a call from Athena, who says that somebody matching Patricia's description has just been brought into a hospital. So they rush off to the hospital.
It's fully nighttime, by the way. She's been gone for, like, almost 24 hours.
It's become evening.
And so they bring Patricia home, right?
I had a feeling you would have something to say about this scene. So they bring Patricia home. Buck is still with them.
Uh-huh.
And Patricia, like, looks at Buck. She's like, is that Tom? I felt so vindicated for a moment because I said in my video that, okay, assuming that most of our listeners are, like, watching the show currently, not all of them probably, but, like, if any, or, like, if they've seen my video or whatever, if they know about what's going on currently on the show, you know, Buck's dating this guy, Tommy, and the joke that we keep referring to in these episodes is that Abby, early in the show, also mentions having an ex named Tommy. And so this is sort of a fan, like, crack theory of, like, obviously this isn't the case, but imagine if it was the same Tommy.
Mm-hmm.
And in this scene, Patricia like mistakes Buck for Tommy. And something I pointed out in my video is that I have always felt that the Tommy that Buck is dating now kind of looks a little too similar to Buck for me to like be on board with their relationship. Yeah. They don't look identical, but like they have kind of similar build, similar hair, whatever.
Yeah.
And so in this moment, I was like, wait, this actually makes me think this is like more evidence for the two Tommies being the same.
Yeah.
If Buck would be mistakable for Tommy, but I realized that the mom has Alzheimer's.
I wrote down in my notes, Jane's gonna love this one. Like,
and you know I did.
I know you did. And like, I just like...
I wrote in my notes, the jokes write themselves.
The reason I go so hard for this fan theory is because like, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but Tommy's not a very common name. Right?
Like, I don't think it's uncommon.
But like Thomas or Tom, sure, but like how many grown adult men do you know go by Tommy, right?
Right, it kind of evokes like a propeller hat little child.
Right, hey Tommy, hey Timmy, hey Jimmy, hey buddy. Like, you know, like it's that sort of thing.
Yes. I need this to be canon now. I started out like admonishing you for even bringing it up, and now I'm like fully on the conspiracy train. Like, yes, it is the same Tommy.
I know exactly how it happened too. Buck would be at Tommy's apartment. He'd find like an old like photo book, and he'd like
be looking through it.
And he'd be like, "How do you know Abby? You know Abby?" And it's like a big moment. And cut to commercial through the mirror of my mind. And then we'd come back, and it'd be like intense standoff almost.
I love, like, all the shippers have been, like, dreaming of all these different ways he could break up with Tommy. What if this is the reason?
This is the reason!
I'm sorry, I just can't date another person who's dated my traumatic ex.
Yeah, literally.
Like, no hard feelings at all, but this is a deal breaker for me.
In fairness, Eddie will have already come out at that point, and so Buck will have seen him as a viable alternative, and,
Wait. I'm so sorry, but also, hasn't there been, like, a recent thing with, like, what the cast and crew have been saying about, like, what's gonna happen next in season 8? Didn't they say that there's gonna be a thing where, like, Buck learns more about Tommy's past and is, like, challenged by that?
Yes, they totally did.
It's canon.
It's canon. It's happening. It's happening.
It's happening. You heard it here first.
Well,
this is what's going to happen. And this is so funny too, because by the time we post this episode, like probably episode 6 and maybe even episode 7 will have already come out.
Yeah.
And almost definitely proved us wrong, but I think we should keep this in.
Just another little time capsule, like we'll know who the president is and we'll also know definitively that we're wrong.
Yes. I'll be a Tommy Abby truther for life, though.
Me too. And honestly, I'm also a truther that Tommy has a wife.
That would be insane. But I'm not really. I can't say I'm a truther for that.
It's
but
okay.
I'll take the Abby thing.
It's okay. I'll do like the really like insane shit. It's okay. I'm happy to do that. But
so then Abby and Buck are saying goodnight. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's also a funny moment with Patricia where she pulls Buck closer and she's like, take care of her.
Like, be kind to Abby. She's like, okay, he says, be kind to her.
Yeah. Did you ever see that SNL sketch? I think it was like a segment they used to do on Weekend Update where Andy Samberg would come on and he would be playing specifically the like jock boyfriend in a teen rom-com who gets like rejected for like the real love interest.
No.
Did you ever see this?
No.
Basically his whole act was he would be like wearing a Letterman jacket. He sort of goes up on there and he's like, "Hey, take care of her, man." And like that was the whole joke basically.
Oh my god.
That's this reminded
fantastic.
Me of that.
That's fantastic. Then we get to Buck and Abby in the kitchen as they're saying goodbye. And, what the fuck kind of game is Buck trying to have? Because, like, what exactly does he say to her here? He's, like, talking about, like, wow, this is the longest I've been hanging out with a woman that I want to have sex with. Without having sex with her.
And Abby jokes, oh, my mom?
Yeah, it's like he's like, it's the nightgown.
Buck yes-ands her. He would be great at improv.
He'd be great at improv. It's the nightgown. It just drives me crazy.
Yeah, kind of a weird exchange, but, you know, they're matching each other's freak. Like, they like each other's humor, apparently.
They are. And honestly, good for them.
So then they kind of resolve to just be phone friends again. In fact, one of them has a line. I think it's Abby. She says, go back to being phone buddies again.
Mm-hmm.
Which I wrote down in my notes with no commentary. Anyway, they say goodbye. But it's a very, like, kind of charged moment where, like, clearly they're very into each other and they've just gotten a lot more attracted to each other by meeting each other in person and, you know, having this intense day. But they say goodbye anyway.
It's not a chaste hug. It's not a chaste embrace. And we'll just say that.
Neither of them want to let go.
Yeah. Then we go back to the firehouse. It's the next day. There's this residual tension between Hen and Bobby. But
Buck walks in feeling like a million bucks.
Hey, a million bucks. And he's got this...
I didn't even do that on purpose.
He's got this big golden retriever energy. I mean, like, a buck is a dog.
He says, Bobby, oh, captain, my handsome captain.
He calls Hen...
My Gary Cooper, Clark Kent-looking captain.
He calls Hen Henrietta. And she threatens to fucking, like, throw him over the balcony.
Yeah. As she should.
And they get their last call of the episode. This guy, he's a car wash attendant, and he gets stuck in the fucking brush.
I assume this must have also been based on a viral video. That was just my only thought.
One assumes. I don't know. So my first job that I ever had, I was a car wash attendant when I was 15.
Did you ever get stuck in the in the spin cycle?
No, because I waited for the fucking thing to turn off all the way before I hosed it down. But I could totally imagine my dumbass 15-year-old self, like, hosing down the car wash and just, like, fucking getting caught up in one of these fucking brushes. And the guy's and the guy's fine. Obviously, he's just, like, really, like, dizzy or whatever. Mm-hmm. He has whiplash.
Yeah, they're checking him out. We finally get a chimney mention, which I'm not sure chimney was even mentioned in the last episode.
Oh, I don't think he was.
We finally get a chimney mention and, you know, just Bobby in passing saying, like, can't wait for Chimney to be back.
Mm-hmm.
But they get the guy totally safe, you know, like you said, he's fine. But then we hear...
fucking laughing.
Buck laughter. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they walk over and he's reviewing the security footage of the guy getting spun around.
Yeah.
Hen is the first to kind of, you know, Bobby's like, that's not funny, but, you know, Hen kind of breaks. I love Aisha Hines, like, acting in this scene. She has some really great moments. She says, like, I'm not laughing.
This is so, like, unprofessional. Like,
completely. Yeah. She's like, her laughter was really funny. I thought Buck sounded a little forced, but, you know, he's still getting his experience.
He is. But you'd expect, like, in, like, a more, like, self-serious show, Bobby to, like, admonish him and be like, Buck, this is not okay. That man could have been seriously hurt. But instead, Bobby starts to break too.
Yeah, Bobby breaks too. And it's like their little bonding moment where they all finally, the tension breaks.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, you know, Hen comes up to Bobby and they finally have a little moment.
Mm-hmm.
What does she say to him? Is she, like, just trying to get him to open up again?
I think so. Yeah. No, he and he does. He tells her, you know, that he lost everything that he cared about, everyone he cared about.
He's been too afraid to let more people get close to him because he's been afraid of losing them again.
Yeah.
But then he says very fun, like, kind of dad energy line where he's like, I'll take you guys back to the station. I'll cook you a meal and I'll introduce you to somebody. And she's like, who? And he says, me.
And it's very sweet. It's like, it's the sort of the wholesome sort of family thing that you sort of go to this show for. And it's good. And it's really good. And so then
final scene. One last sequence between Buck and Abby. Abby's putting her mom to bed. Abby, so iconic. With Abby is wearing, like, an oversized button-up shirt only as her pajamas, and she's holding a huge glass of white wine.
And
she gets a call from Buck, and Buck is lying in bed shirtless.
Yeah, tits out. His fucking, like...
Tits out. He's got the covers on.
He's got the covers pulled up, you know.
We've got to stop sexualizing Buck so much. I felt kind of uncomfortable listening to our last episode. Or no, one of our, maybe our fourth episode.
No, we probably should. It's probably pretty irresponsible. I mean, if the show sexualizes
Buck... He's not
Buck,
just a piece of meat, Ryan.
The Buck 1.0 or Buck on the whole?
True. Is it ethical to sexualize Buck as long as it's Buck 1.0?
As long as... No, I mean, like, I mean, this is the show's whole, like, thing with him, right, in the first season, right? Is that he's a very sort of right. sexualized presence, and then he becomes... a little bit more, I guess, mellowed out as the show goes on. All I'm saying is
he
gets less slutty. All I'm saying is I am riding the high while it lasts.
Fair enough. But they start talking on the phone, and you can tell Buck's just like up to something. Basically, Abby, okay, I first of all love the energy of Abby getting into bed with a glass of wine.
Yes.
Like, I've definitely, like, sometimes, like, you're hanging out just, like, sitting on your bed, and I've had wine in that situation. I can't say I've ever, like, gotten into my pajamas, gotten under the covers with a glass of wine, but now that's, like, on my bucket list. I think that's iconic of her.
All I'll say is, I totally have.
Fair enough. No, I think that's the way to live. I think I've been depriving myself.
I just want to enjoy the irony of you saying we need to sexualize Buck less on the scene where he has phone sex with Abby.
Okay. I'm being a little over the top. Whatever.
Because, you know, they're talking on the phone and he goes, "What are you wearing?" Right.
And, yes, he asked the classic. First, he's like asking her if she's in bed. She says, "Yeah, I'm in bed." And then, he asked the classic, "What are you wearing?" And the episode just kind of cuts.
Yeah. Well, it's like
tasteful cutaway.
It's like he goes, like, "Do you want me to stop?" And she goes, "No."
No.
And we love a consent asking king.
True.
You know,
even phone sex needs consent, otherwise you're just one of those creepy phone callers in a slasher movie.
Exactly. So how do we feel about this episode?
I know you said you're not a huge fan of the structure. It's like I said, I think it works for me. Like, it probably could be cleaner, but I don't think anything really didn't work. I love to hear more about Bobby's tragic backstory. You know, it gives us so much context. I, again, kind of digging the Buck and Abby thing, which I didn't really anticipate on this rewatch.
Yeah.
But we love that.
Yeah.
Loved the hen stuff. Overall, like, as much as the structure is kind of weird, I like how much we get of all our characters in this episode, other than Chimney, obviously.
Oh, poor Chim.
Who is presumably, like, still comatose in the hospital.
He'll be back, I want to say, next episode,
It must be, yeah. I don't think he's missing for that long.
No, I wouldn't think so. No, I definitely think that's the biggest revelation for me on this rewatch is just how much I'm enjoying the Buck Abby storyline.
What's their ship name? Is it Babby?
I just think it's Buck Abby.
Oh, okay. Because Babby's kind of ugly.
Babby is
and
ugly.
And you can't do, like, Uck.
No, I think it's just Buck Abby.
Fair enough.
That's how you know Buddy Cannon, because that's the only Buck ship name that has a good portmanteau. Yeah, I think, you know, I'm really, really curious about the Hen Eva stuff, how much attention that's going to get in the narrative going forward. Because I remember it getting quite a bit of screen time.
There are some other things that happen in this season.
Yeah,
for sure.
I remember it leading to a bit of frustration on my end with Hen's character, in that I was basically just pounding on my TV screen like, "No, Hen, stop. You have a family." Like,
yeah, we'll have to deal with that when we get to it.
Yeah, but for now, all is of relative peace in the Wilson family. And I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes from here. You know, as much as the structure pained me a little bit, I did enjoy all of the time with Bobby's story. I think his story is definitely one of the most interesting for me. And I'm looking forward to exploring it more in the dedicated Bobby episode in season two. When we sort of are, I guess, prepared to set aside that sort of amount of time for it. But yeah, I think great performances this episode, really good character writing and good development, especially after such an action-packed last few episodes. I think scaling it back and having a more character-focused episode this time was definitely warranted.
Yeah. I mean, they just pack so much into this season. It's pretty wild. I believe our next episode is the Valentine's Day episode, which is exciting. So stay tuned for next week. We will be covering season one, episode 6. I think it's called Heartbreaker.
Heartbreaker. Look forward to that, kids. And just remember.
And hopefully our country still has a democracy.
Yeah.
By the time you hear this. I hope everybody got out and voted. You know, I know it's not the rosiest year, but there are some choices that are worse than others. Yeah. So I hope we all made the right one.
And just remember, no matter what happens, one day he'll die. And we can all take comfort in that.
True.
And so with that, thank you for listening to this episode of the First Risk Podcast. You can find us on Twitter and on YouTube and TikTok now. We are on TikTok.
We do technically have a TikTok. Our first two TikToks pretty much flopped.
Yeah.
However, on YouTube Shorts, they did okay. They got a few hundred views.
Oh, nice. Okay. Well, that makes sense. Like, we're YouTubers, so that's kind of our natural domain.
I don't really know how any of these things work, but basically, we got, like, no views on TikTok. But, you know, we're trying.
We're trying. We're making it work.
But, yeah, we're on YouTube now. And we're trying to post, like, some highlights and outtakes on, like, our YouTube Shorts and our TikTok and stuff. That's just all at First Risk Podcast. As always, you can find us on Twitter at First Risk Podcast.
Spelled how it sounds.
Spelled how it sounds.
There's nothing else called First Risk Podcast out there, so we pretty much have all the usernames cornered.
Nothing at all.
You can find me on Twitter at Dan, Dirty, and on Instagram at Prime Minister of Sadness. I also upload videos occasionally. I am working on one right now, so stay tuned for that.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Jane_Mulcahy. Don't ask me about Instagram. And honestly, we should just start putting our socials in like the descriptions of these episodes, because I feel like it's getting kind of tedious to plug them every single time.
Honestly, yeah.
But also always be plugging.
Always be plugging. Don't stop plugging, you know.
Yeah. Keep watching my 911 video over and over again, because it's got good legs and I want it to just keep getting views until I'm rich and famous.
Yes. Is it monetized?
It sure is.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, Fox and ABC, for not copyright claiming my video.
Hey, that's awesome.
There is nothing. Here's like a little YouTuber behind the curtain thing, is that there is nothing that feels better than uploading a video to YouTube, certain it's going to get a bunch of copyright claims and that you're going to have to re-edit it a bunch of times. Yep. And then it goes through checks. No issues found.
Green dollar sign.
That feels great.
Oh, it feels so good.
Green dollar sign.
It's only happened to me a couple of times. I remember when I uploaded my Teen Wolf video, it was the most grueling editing process of any video I've ever made in my entire life. And then the upload process took about 8 hours, because I was on, like, you know, I'm still on the same computer I uploaded it on, and it's, you know, it's nice, but it's, you know, it's not the highest end computer in the world. And, I got it there and I got 40 copyright claims from Paramount,
my God.
And I had to dispute them all individually. They were all rejected and I had to appeal them all individually.
Oh my God.
And to
did
this,
it work?
It worked on like 99% of them, but there's one of them that is still on there. And so to this day, my Teen Wolf video is still demonetized.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That sucks so bad.
I did not make a penny off of that video.
Oh my God. Everybody Venmo Ryan $5.
Yes, pay my rent.
If you watched the Teen Wolf video, you owe him money.
You owe me money. $1 for every hour you watched.
No, I feel like I've gotten pretty good at like sensing like how much footage is too much footage to use in any individual thing, like when to cut back to myself. I basically just try and cover up like my jump cuts and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, I actually had several places in the 911 video where I was pretty sure I had used like too long of a clip and I was going to get flagged, but then it just didn't. So that was amazing.
Hell yeah, dude.
Whenever I get a copyright claim for something, it always gives me the vibe that whatever property it is like insecure, you know? So when I get copyright claims about Teen Wolf, I'm like, oh, you need my pennies, huh?
Right.
Paramount?
Right, right. Oh, you guys aren't doing well financially? Oh, this last fiscal quarter wasn't so good for you, huh? Yeah, take my money. Take my money.
You have to steal from a poor 23-year-old?
In St. Paul, Minnesota.
God.
All right. Well, with that, we'll probably cut the recording here. So thanks again for listening. And see you on the other side of this fucking election.
On the other side, truly. Truly. Yes. This concludes the election night special.
Yeah. Have a good night, Respodcasters.